Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking to begin the show about women in fly fishing. Jen Ripple is the editor-in-chief of Dunn Magazine, an international women's fly fishing magazine. She's a professional fly angler and fly fishing educator. She grew up in Wisconsin. Jen Ripple, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, Larry. Thank you so much for having me on.
Great to have you here. Jesse Nixon, our other guest to start the show. Jesse's the educational engagement specialist with PBS Wisconsin Education. She's joining us for the first part of the show to talk about an educational resource she co-produced. It's called Carrie Frost, Fly Fishing Boss. Jesse, welcome to you.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you.
Okay, so as we listen to these two visit with us, maybe you can join in. Are you a fly fisher? What do you love about doing it? Any questions maybe about its history, how it got started? Lots of things we can talk about. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Jen, before we talk about the history and your own journey into fly fishing, can you just talk about what fly fishing is, what sets it apart from other kinds of fishing?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So the main difference between fishing with a fly and fishing with a lure would be the cast and the line. So a lot of times people have seen a river runs through it, and they see anglers out on the water with the carrying that huge long line in the air. It's very mesmerizing. Well, the difference is that in a conventional fishing state, you are using a lure that is weighted, and our flies don't weigh anything. So the way that we get our fly to our target is through a weighted line. And that's why you'll see that big line, and it's usually color coded. It's got, you know, it's not just clear like you'd expect with a monofilament. So that line is actually weighted, and we're not just out there throwing the line in the air because we like it, although we do, you know, it's really to present the fly. And so that's the main difference between fishing, conventional fishing, and then fishing with a fly. It's the presentation of the lure and the fly.
Yeah, that's a good description. Jesse, let's get you involved. Jesse Nixon, talk first about what's the Wisconsin Biographies Project.
Thanks, Larry. Yeah, Wisconsin Biographies is our classroom media for grades 3 through 8. We have 16 stories of famous Wisconsinites. They're biographies that include an animated video, a reader, image gallery. And so it really helps students in Wisconsin connect to their home and to their state by learning about famous people in the state. So Carrie Frost is one of them. Other examples of Wisconsin biographies include stories of Gaylord Nelson and Elizabeth Baird and Harley Davidson.
Well, some pretty cool people. I'm thinking about focusing on Carrie Frost. She was from the Stevens Point area, if I'm not mistaken. Tell us about what you learned about her and her contributions to fly fishing.
Yeah, Carrie Frost. So this stems from our hometown stories with PBS. And Carrie Frost was chosen from educators in Wisconsin as a really important story to tell about Stevens Point. So Carrie grew up and was born in 1868. She grew up in a time when fly fishing was really considered a man's sport, but her father was a skilled angler, and she loved fly fishing even as a young girl. She started working as a teacher after high school, but always wanted to do something more with fishing. And so one day she was out on the water trying to catch a fish, and she was noticing that the fish weren't biting. At that time, most of the flies were European and actually brought into Wisconsin. And so Carrie wondered, I wonder if I started making flies with local feathers and furs, if the Wisconsin fish would bite. And alas, they did. And the anglers around Stevens Point started taking notice, and there were huge demands to get Carrie's ties. So she started actually in her parents' kitchen. She brought in a housekeeper, and they started tying flies there in the kitchen. And it grew and grew. And finally, Carrie Frost opened up her own business. She called it the CJ Frost Company because at that time she was concerned that her business would not be successful if people knew that it was a female-run business. So at one point, Carrie employed over 150 employees in Stevens Point, and almost all of them were women. So she really was she was an entrepreneur. She provided opportunities for women in Stevens Point. And there were really very few women that owned any businesses during that time.
That is very, very cool. Jen Carrie Frost made a difference, I think, because she used local natural elements on her flies. I'm wondering, how do today's flies compare to something Carrie might have made?
Oh, that's a great question. So I would say that the flies today, we still use some of the standard wet fly patterns that she used, which is just basically some hackle feathers tied to make a lot of motion to be kind of like what we call swung on a fly. We still tie those to this day. I would say that one of the best things about Carrie Frost and the flies that she tied, yes, they were made from the local materials, which was super important, but she also tied flies that looked like the bugs that were in her area. And I think that's a super important part because, you know, flies in the English waters did not always compare the color and the size to what she was seeing in Wisconsin. And I think that added as well. That was a whole nother layer that she did that added to the success of her flies. And that's something that's thinking outside of the box and saying, hey, you know, these work over there, but this is not what the fish are seeing. And I think that's important. Today, you know, we tie a lot of different flies. Back in those days, they were just tying what they call dry flies or wet flies, which were small little trout flies. Today, we tie flies for everything. You know, I mean, it's not unusual to go fish a fly for a shark, you know, or fish giant patterns that imitate minnows. And I would say that's the biggest difference now is that we tie bait fish patterns and larger fish patterns as well as the flies that Carrie was tying.
Very, very cool. Jesse, where can people find the resources you created?
You can go to pbswisconsineducation.org/biographies to access the Carrie Frost. There's a wonderful animated video and a reader that provides more of a biography of Carrie.
Well, I really want to thank you so much for joining us today, Jesse. I hope a lot of people get to see Carrie Frost Fly Fishing Boss for the Wisconsin Biographies. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Jesse Nixon, Educational Engagement Specialist with PBS Wisconsin Education. So she's leaving us right now. But Jen Ripple is staying with us to answer your questions and comments and talk fly fishing. I hope you'll join in. Number to call 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call. Debbie in Beaver Dam, thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Love your show. I just called to say that my dad had taught me how to fly fish when he was alive, and we used to go all the time for the salmon run up in Door County at the Stony Creek up in Door County. And he did get a salmon that was put in the Hall of Fame for the lightest what do you call it? Tippet.
Lightest line?
Yeah. And it was close to 30 pound salmon. But I enjoyed it. I never caught as many as he did, but
but you liked it anyway. Well, thanks a lot, Debbie, for calling. Comment from you, Jen, and maybe talk about the number of women who do fly fish.
Yeah, first of all, Debbie, I think it's amazing that your dad took you out there because I think a lot of fathers overlook the fact that their daughters might want to try this. And so kudos to your dad, and I think it's amazing. I mean, the fishing up in Door County for salmon is a truly spectacular one, and if you could do that, you could fish for anything anywhere, I believe. So, honestly, women are the biggest growing demographic in fly fishing, in fishing in general, but in fly fishing specifically. And I would say that's been a trend that's been going on for at least the last 3 years. You know, it used to be, and I think it's for a number of reasons, but it used to be considered such a male-dominated sport, or even such an exclusive sport that was out of reach for a lot of people, you know, too expensive. You'd have to fly into Alaska or go on these, you know, buy these $1,000 rods. And, you know, and you can still do that today, but we have made, you know, as an industry, fly fishing has, you know, the manufacturers have made it so much more approachable for the everyday angler out there. And I think as women, one of the things that's helped a lot in getting more women involved in the sport is seeing other women on social media that are actually doing it, right? Everyday women picking up a fly rod. And, you know, that's what we do. We tell the everyday angler story, because I think that that's the most empowering way to get women involved in this sport. If they see someone that is just an everyday woman who has picked up a fly rod and had a great time, whether she caught fish or she didn't catch fish, that's something that women then look at and say, hey, maybe this is an activity that I can do with my friends, with my family, with my kids. And women in droves are picking up a fly rod and getting back out there. And it's exciting to see, because if you study the history of women in fly fishing, you know, Carrie Frost was a number and a big player in a vast history of women who laid the foundation for other women to come along and get involved in the sport.
Yeah, Ellie in Madison emailed. She's so glad that we're talking about non-traditional fly fishers like Carrie Frost on the show today. She's a femme-identifying fly angler, Ellie, and tying flies and fishing are her favorite things to do, but often it seems like it's a sport for old white guys. It's such a cool sport, and she'd love to see more women, LGBTQ folk, and people of color getting involved.
Agreed. I absolutely agree. You know, there is a Facebook group called Wisconsin Women Fly Anglers, and that is a really good resource. I think they have something like 80 women involved right now. So if she gets on the Facebook group, they do outings all over the state of Wisconsin. So that might be a really good resource for her.
Yeah, absolutely. Ryan in Milwaukee, we'll go to you now. Hi, Ryan.
Yes. Good morning, Larry. I'm listening to this, and it reminded me of my own beginnings with fly fishing. My grandfather taught me to fly fish when I was 6 years old. He's from Ireland. So he was teaching me how to tie itty-bitty flies. But I learned in central Pennsylvania, and the creeks there are very narrow, so you never had to cast very far. Anyway, the first time I went to Florida to fly fish, it was in Marco Island, and we had hired a guide, and the guide looked at my partner and I. He said, there's a fish about 100 yards away, directly ahead. I need you to cast at it. I looked at him like he lost his ever-living mind. 100 yards? I mean, I was capable of casting, like, 2 yards. Dropping a fly was really, you know, a dry fly, you could drop it in a creek and it would float down, and you could usually catch something if it was well tied. Anyway, so I cast, and the false casts were happening, and finally he looked at me and he said, would you please stop? He says, your casting is giving me a headache. Anyway, he spent the next 3 hours of our guided tour teaching me how to cast, which, amazingly enough, by the end of the day, I was able to cast pretty effectively at 75, 100 yards. So, you know, don't get depressed by casting in Wisconsin streams, like the little, you know, stream that runs around the Kenosha Country Club and such. Because even though it's effective there, when you go down south, if you get one guy who can spend a couple hours with you, you'll be an expert if you learn how to cast initially.
Okay, Ryan, thanks for calling. Jen, a comment?
Yeah, that is so true. You know, it's funny, when I first, so I learned to fish in Michigan and then in Illinois and Wisconsin. And so, you know, when I went down to the first time to fish for saltwater, it was at the ladies' tarpon tournament. I mean, I figured go big or go home, right? And it was... Fly fishing in salt water, like Ryan has just mentioned, is everything that I don't think about when I think about fishing in the Wisconsin waters, or specifically for trout. It's like hours of standing on the front of a flats boat with a fly in your hand, just sheer boredom, just scanning the horizon, and then seconds of sheer terror where you forget how to tell time and how to cast, because the guide will say something like, you know, 70 feet, 3 o'clock. And you're like, where's 3 o'clock? I don't know where 3 o'clock is anymore. You know, it is a totally different ball game. But man, Ryan, if you had a guide who could teach you to cast like that, you know, that is a great guide. And there are great guides in the Keys and in saltwater. There are some not such great guides as well. So if you get one that is not like what Ryan is explaining, don't give up. go hire another guide. It is a different ball of wax, but it's also so exciting and just a different set of skills that you can add to your fly fishing repertoire.
Yeah, that's a great, great story, Ryan. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it very much. Well, our guest right now, Jen Ripple, editor-in-chief of Dunn Magazine, an international women's fly magazine. She's a professional angler, fly fishing educator. Great to have her with us today. Great to have you listening in. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Natalie Guyette, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at fly fishing today on the show and women in fly fishing with our guest, Jen Ripple, editor and publisher of Dunn Magazine, professional fly angler and fly fishing educator. It's great to have her with us today. Questions give or maybe an experience to share, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And Jen, you grew up in Wisconsin, but you didn't get fly fishing until later.
That's true. I grew up in West Bend, Wisconsin on Wallace Lake. And, you know, my brother and my sister were the anglers in the family. I was not. I was more like spending all of my time in the dance studio. In fact, my mom says, if I would have known that you were going to be the angler in the family, I would have lost $1 million on that bet because I was not about fishing at all when I lived on Wallace Lake. And then I was working at the University of Michigan, and the Huron River, which is a bass river, runs right to the campus of the University of Michigan. And one really, really cold winter night, I was on Craigslist looking for something to do. And I found a fly tying class that was going on. And, you know, so I came into fly fishing through the back door of fly tying, kind of like Carrie Frost did, right? And so, you know, that's where my love started. From the moment I walked in the door for my first fly tying class, I just fell in love with everything that was fly fishing.
Well, I tell you, that's a great, great story. I love it. And you mentioned Carrie Frost, and we talked a little about her, but what can you talk about relating to women in sport, in the sport in general? Have there always been women involved in it?
Well, so interesting that you asked that. The first book of fly fishing ever written was written by a woman in the 15th century. And so she was a nun of noble birth. Her name was Dame Juliana Berners. And she wrote The Three Types of Fishing with an Angle. And it's a very small, concise book, as you would expect from the 15th century. And, you know, it was it's so all-encompassing for such a small book. It talks about, you know, how to take horsehair and dye it for different types of water conditions, how to tie a fly, how to make a rod, how to make a hook, actually, you know. And then on top of all of that, she talks about conservation, how to protect the waters, how not to trespass and all of that. And so when I found out that a woman actually wrote the first book of fly fishing, I thought, well, you know, why did she write that? Maybe because she was an avid angler, which she was. And I thought, well, maybe she was bored because she was a nun and of noble birth. So it's not like she was out working and trying to survive every day. But in reality, that book came about because back in the 15th century, if you wanted to do an activity, it had to be condoned by the church. And in order for it to be condoned by the church, there had to be a document that the priest could bless, and that's the document. And so it's a very fascinating, you know, stone in the foundation of women's fly fishing to know that the first book was made, you know. And on that premise, it's a really, really interesting story that we start our foundation on.
Oh, that is really cool. I did not know that. Well, and here you are, all these centuries later. You run the only women's fly fishing magazine, editor in chief. Do you feel like talk about how that happened?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I don't have a background in publishing or journalism or anything, but I love to write, and I was writing for, by happenstance, a Midwest fly fishing magazine called A Tight Loop, and I was writing their women's column for that magazine. And, you know, the articles that I was writing, you know, it was predominantly a male magazine, a magazine that was put out there for the male fly anglers. And I really, you know, I wanted to write a really meaty, important story for a woman's magazine. And so I looked around for one to write for, and I discovered that there wasn't one. So that was in June of 2013. And at that point, that day, I contacted the publisher and the editor of A Tight Loop magazine, and I said, hey, what do you think about me starting a woman's fly fishing magazine? And he was like, oh, there's got to be one out there already. And so he did a little research for the next day and found out that there wasn't one. And so at that moment, I started contacting anybody and everybody that I could find who was a woman flying lure that I thought was doing some cool things out there and asking if they would write articles for us. And by September, we had our first magazine.
That is an amazing, amazing story. I love it. Stephen Ashland has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. Yes, my wife started a fishing group several years ago, Superior's Real Women, and they did fly fishing exclusively on Shawmigan Bay and Lake Superior and the streams and lakes, inland lakes around the area. They did several outings, went camping, overnight stays with fishing in mind.
Wow, that's fantastic. What was the name of, or what is the name of her group?
Superior Real Women.
I love
Superior
it.
Superior Rural Women or Real Women?
Real Women.
Real Women. Superior Real Women.
Fantastic. I love that.
I do too. Thanks for that, for sharing that, Steve. Appreciate it. Mike in Minocqua will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how you doing? I'm enjoying your show. I have three daughters and two granddaughters, and I've always fished with them with lures, and so I was interested in this topic, and I had two questions. One is upper body strength. As little girls, I have a granddaughter who's 6 and one who's 10. You know, is the upper body strength okay for fly fishing? And two, what about the lakes? We mostly have clear water lakes up north there, and I was just wondering how those lakes are for fly fishing.
All right, yeah, so go ahead. I'm sorry, Jen. Go ahead.
Sorry about that. So a couple things. First of all, the number one best caster in the world at this moment is a young girl named Maxine McCormick. So fly fishing has absolutely nothing to do with strength, which makes it perfect for young and old women and men alike. The lakes that you have are perfect for teaching them. So I'll give you a few pointers to making them successful. So first of all, the 6-year-old is probably too young to hold a full fly rod, but maybe not, depending on her size. If the fly rod that's 9 feet long, you can get them in 8 feet as well, shorter rods, even 7 feet. But if the rod is too long, you can always break it in half and have her hold the line where that fly rod is broken in half. You know, they come apart. So right there, that would make a shorter rod for her. But second of all, I think that it's very possible for someone who's 6 and especially 10 years old to cast a rod. It's not about the strength. It's about the stop. So to make a good fly cast, you have to make sure that you make a back cast. So it's all about the back cast and stopping your rod tip nice and high behind you. You can find some videos online about this, and I'd be happy to connect with you as well. And the lakes are the perfect place to make them successful. And summertime is the perfect time. So when you think about taking a child or any new angler out fishing, you want to make them successful so that they pick up the fly rod again, right? So that they can catch a fish and feel successful. And the way to do that is in the summer months, if you think about it and you look around, there's a lot of terrestrials that are on the land right around the lakes, grasshoppers, crickets, ants, that kind of thing. And if you think about when an ant or a grasshopper falls in the water, they're spastic, right? They're really, really, they're nervous and they're afraid and they're like hopping around like crazy. So if you put something that is a dry fly or something that's going to sit up on top of the water, like a terrestrial pattern, an ant, a grasshopper, a cricket, something like that, a young angler or a new angler does not have to have a perfect drift in order to catch a fish with that, because the motion that they're making, even though because they don't know what they're doing, is going to be like a natural presentation for that type of bug. So putting something like that on the end of the line and then going to a local lake where there are bluegill and bass is perfect, because those bass and bluegill are both very, very aggressive. They love to eat flies and they love to eat on top water. So the young girls can actually cast the fly out there. They won't have to cast very far. You know, you can cast it out there. You make a couple, you know, improper strips with your, or bouncing around the terrestrial, and they will see the fish come up and try to eat that. And that's where the excitement is. And make sure, too, that you bring a lot of snacks along because they're going to get tired and that it's a beautiful day so they're not cold and crabby.
Yeah. And you kind of figure according to the age of the youngster, the number of hours perhaps that you might spend on the water with them. Maybe the first time out, you wouldn't spend as much time as you would later on. You kind of have to judge that a little bit because you don't want them to get bored, right,
yeah, absolutely,
Jen?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I have to say that that's where I had my introduction to fly fishing was on a lake, a small lake, with a friend who was a fly fisher. And it's a whole lot easier out on a lake where there aren't any benches overhanging or anything else to get in the way. And you can learn, and even caught some bluegills on that first time out. So it's a great way to learn, for sure.
Absolutely.
Mike, thanks. Mike in Oconomowoc, your turn. Hi.
Hi. What a great program. I'm so glad to have found this while I just jumped in my car. I had a friend of mine who brought me into the world of fly fishing, and as far as I was concerned, fishing had gotten kind of boring, just casting and reeling, and fly fishing was a complete rebirth and rejuvenation of the whole fishing experience. And he took me, when I first was learning, out with a nine-foot pole, a five-weight line, no fly on it. And we just sat in a big open park that had plenty of space, no trees, and we just cast. Because, I mean, you're just trying to get the line to load. And once, you know, you started to establish that and you weren't getting a lot of wind knots, you know, it became really easy. And then we just started hitting the lakes around here in a canoe. He'd face in one direction, I'd face in the other, and luckily miss each other most of the time. And and just had a great time. I mean, fly fishing is just, it's such a peaceful, wonderful, cathartic state that you feel like you're in when you're fishing. I really enjoyed it. So I'm really happy to share that. And what a great show.
Oh, Mike, thanks so much. Jen, a comment.
Yeah, for sure. So first of all, that 9 foot five weight, if you want to get into fishing specifically in your area, in the Wisconsin area, that 9 foot five weight is going to be the perfect rod. So if you're wondering what you're going to want to go out and get that. It is the most versatile of all the fly rods. And you know what? Your friend was exactly right. Taking you to a park where you could just cast a rod until you get the feeling of it is the best way to learn how to cast.
Thank you so much. Jen, you've been fly fishing all over the world. Certain areas of the world that have larger communities of people doing it. I'm thinking about like Ireland, maybe over mm-hmm. in that part.
Yeah, so in the UK specifically, there are a lot of fly anglers. And of course in England, right? So when you think about fishing with a fly, we were getting our flies from Europe, right? From England. And so that area is very predominantly fly angler, you know, friendly. I would say in the United States, there are a lot of places as well. So, you know, if you can fish with a fly rod in any water where it's legal to fish, right? You can fish for anything from bluegill to shark. But up in the Pacific Northwest, there's so much water. And you know what? I think a lot of people don't realize that in Wisconsin, there is world-class water right in the Driftless area of Wisconsin. 3,000 miles of spring creeks. Almost all of them are public access only. So, you know, when I think about fishing in the world, yeah, I fished in Cuba and I fished in, you know, you name it, I fished in it. I still come back to my home waters there in my home state in the Driftless area because people from other countries are coming there to fish. You know, we yeah. discount it all the time, but it is some of the best water in the world right there in your own backyard.
Well, there you have it. How do people, by the way, learn about more about Dunn Magazine?
So you can go to, so dun is actually spelled D-U-N. It is a stage of the mayfly, and the mayfly is one of the most prominent hatches that we follow in fly fishing. And so they can go to dunmagazine.com and find out more about it. And they can always, through the website, they can pop me an email or just jen@dunmagazine.com as well. I'm always happy to connect anglers, get more people on the water, answer any questions that they might have.
Well, Jen, you are a great guest. Thank you so much. I hope we can have you back again. Love to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pure joy to speak with you.
All right. Thank you so much. Well, Jen Ripple, editor and chief of Dun Magazine, professional fly angler and fly fishing educator. It was so much fun to have her talk about enthusiasm. She's got enthusiasm for sure. And somebody else with a lot of enthusiasm is Megan Hart, sports reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. And she's joining us for a few minutes just to kind of catch up on what's going on with Wisconsin sports, especially Wisconsin professional sports. We've got the Bucks, we got the Brewers, we've got the Packers. And I want to hear what she's got, what she's thinking about some of them. Megan Hart, welcome. Thanks for stopping by.
Hi, thanks for having me, Larry.
So, the Bucks look pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
In the first round of the playoffs.
Definitely. I think, you know, of course, with what happened last year, the Miami Heat beat the Bucks pretty badly in five games in the bubble. The Heat were an attractive pick. And if people weren't picking the Heat to win this first round series, you know, I think a lot of people thought it was at least going to go beyond four games. It was at least going to be competitive, but the Bucks were just really dominant. And I think after Saturday's game, Giannis Antetokounmpo made a comment that we didn't want to play with our food, kind of showing the attitude that the Bucks took into that series. And it was a lot of fun to see too, I think, because the first game of the series, game one, they won in overtime. Game two was just an absolute blowout. The Bucks won by about 34 points, I think.
Yeah.
And then this past game, game four, they put together a comeback. So to see them win in different ways, to get through moments of adversity, it was pretty encouraging, I think, for Bucks fans.
Oh, absolutely. And they played a different kind of defense. The way they played last year versus this year and who was guarding who and so forth was quite a bit different.
Yeah, Giannis was Jimmy Butler from the Heat, who is their star player, had a great series last year. And of course, Giannis was out for part of that with an injury, but he just couldn't find that same magic this time around. And I think a lot of that had to do with Giannis mostly covering him. He looked great. I think, you know, we saw this in the regular season. Coach Budenholzer was willing to take some chances, try out some different things, especially on defense. And we've seen so far just in this first series, he's been willing to have Giannis play more minutes, not be so strict about kind of who's playing when, but be a little bit more flexible, which I think will serve them this playoff. So yeah, it's amazing. It looks very different than in many ways than a year ago. Of course, last year, the Bucks had the best record in the league before the coronavirus disrupted the season. So they were going into the playoffs, I think, with a lot of pressure as the top seed, but they were in the crazy bubble situation. They also took kind of a leadership role among NBA teams in the social justice movement. So I think that added some pressure. But this year, you know, you can see things have, it's just a completely different.
Well, the Brewers are on a little winning streak right now. It's been fun watching and listening to them. The season's coming along reasonably well. They went through I don't know what you'd call it, the dark period there for a little bit. But talk about the Brewers.
Yeah, the Brewers are, they've won five in a row. They're 8-2 in their last 10. And, you know, I would say that they're still sort of figuring things out on the offensive side, but they've had some great pitching and they've had some really clutch performances when they need them. And, you know, I have to say, I grew up in Tampa, so I grew up a Rays fan, and they just had a trade with the Rays for Willy Adames, who is their new shortstop. And I think, you know, I was kind of surprised by that because he's not really known for his offensive prowess, but he's a great leader and was really kind of the heart of our team in Tampa. And I think, you know, he's kind of put a bit of a jolt in the team. And they've just looked like they've been having fun the last couple of weeks, which I think is really important in baseball.
Yeah. And, we were having quite a few errors at shortstop.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which might have been the reason why.
Yeah, I guess, you know, at some point you have to pull the trigger on somebody to solve one of the problems. But yeah, I think that's he's certainly solid on defense. And it seems like they have been able to move Arias over to third base when they're playing lefties, and he's had success on behind, you know, at bat. So I think they're kind of working through some of the issues you know, that they've had so far at the beginning of the season, and it's been a lot of fun. And they even won a couple games off the Padres, which was great because the Padres, I think, you know, most people probably would consider the best team in the league. So yeah, it's been a good week.
And now we have more fans.
Yeah,
now they're
definitely
allowing more fans. The sausages.
Yeah, things are getting way, way more back to normal. And they're having a reopening day on June 25th. So they'll be back at 100% capacity. And of course, opening day was such a fun day because they had a comeback win and they had fans for the first time in a long time. But I think this is really going to be the first time where things will feel back to normal at American Family Field.
I've got to get my tickets. I've been watching on TV or listening on radio, so it's time to get over there and watch them in person again. It's so much fun there. It's a great venue, a great place to watch. You know, anything on Rodgers and the Packers? I saw Adrian Amos was quoted in a story here saying that the defense has to be great. The Packers defense has to be great this year, regardless of who's in there at quarterback.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think that's probably the approach that that they should take, because it seems like a lot is still up in the air. Matt Schneidman from The Athletic just had a piece out talking about how it seems like the Packers are fairly certain that Rodgers is bluffing. Of course, who knows? They've got a mandatory mini camp coming up later this month, so we should find out more before then. But you know, he seems to think if that the Packers are convinced that Rodgers will be back, because if there's a chance he won't, then they really stand to lose a lot by not just trading him. So, and of course he was on SportsCenter last week, I think it was, and kind of shared his side of the story. And, you know, it's really interesting how this has kind of captivated so much national attention, even from people who, you know, maybe aren't that interested in the sports side of things. He's a big star. And so hearing him talk about kind of how, he's not mad at the Jordan Love pick that kind of maybe set off this whole rift with the team, but kind of the way it was handled and that he wasn't looped in the decision-making process and he hasn't really felt valued by the organization. And so it's, you know, I think we will have answers at this point sooner rather than later. So at least there's that. Yeah.
And on that happy note, oh, Megan, thanks so much. We'll hopefully we'll have a chance to do this again next month.
Thanks. I'll talk to you later, Larry.
Thanks, Megan. Megan Hart, sports reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have her with us. Well, obviously, this first Tuesday of the month is always a sports day, and we're covering a lot of things. We started with fly fishing. And we're going to stay in the, and then we got Megan Hart, and then we're going back into the water. How about paddling? And maybe paddling. Maybe camping. That coming up next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.